Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for attending the 2013 Fundraising Success Virtual Conference and Expo. I hope you're enjoying everything so far. This is Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success. I am so pleased to welcome you to our session, Creating Multigenerational Giving Within Families. This is a very special session that allows you a glimpse into the minds and hearts of two donors whose families support various causes. They'll provide important insights into how to engage the next generation of donors. But before we get started, let me review some technical pointers. First, if you have any technical issues, troubleshoot by clicking on the widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the question and answer box. You can also use the question and answer box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the session, and you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the features on this console. Check out the Tips for Attendees widget if you'd like to learn about the console you're viewing on today. If you're looking to get CFRE credits for attending this session, please pay attention at the end when I sign off, as I'll be going over how to obtain the tracking document for that at that time. And finally, if you'd like to view this session again later, don't forget that we'll be archiving the entire show today. We'll have the on-demand environment up and running for 3 months beginning on Monday, September 16th. So watch your email for more details. Okay, with that out of the way, please welcome our moderator for today's discussion, Sharna Goldsecker. With nearly 20 years of experience in the nonprofit sector, Sharna is the managing director of 2164, a nonprofit consulting practice specializing in next generation and multi-generational engagement in philanthropy and family enterprise. Sharna, will you take it from here and introduce your special guests?
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having us today. Looking forward to speaking with you all about creating multi-generational giving within families. At 2164, I've been working with families who are engaging their next generation family members in their philanthropy and collaborating across the generations and supporting and training advisors to those families as well. I thought today, in the little bit of time we have together, I would help to set that multi-generational context. What does it mean to work with multiple generations at once, as well as share some research we've recently fielded on next generation donors in particular, and give you some strategies for how to work with them. And then I'm going to invite in two real live next gen donors with whom I have the pleasure of working to share some of their experiences, and we'll have a back and forth conversation, keep it interactive, and then open the floor to you and any of your questions. So please jot them down, and we're going to have some time at the end for that. So before we dive in, I just want to take a quick poll to see what generation are you from, so we have a sense of who's on the phone today. So if you can just take a minute to actually click on your screen. Are you a traditionalist born between 1925 to 45, a baby boomer born between 1946 and 64, a Gen Xer between 65 and 80, or a Gen Yer between 81 and 2000? So if you go ahead and click on the circle next to each of those and then hit submit, we should be able in a minute or so to see the tally. Great, that's really helpful. So 40% boomers, 33 or 34% Xers, 26 Yers. Okay, super. And then our next quick polling question, do you have experience fundraising from next generation donors? If you could click yes or no and submit. No, okay. So some of you, 25% of you do, and the others no. So great. Hopefully we'll offer you some productive tangible take-homes today. So let me just start by setting this multi-generational context. The field of philanthropy, I believe, really was a conversation between trust and estate attorneys and individuals who were setting up foundations or donor-advised funds in their estate planning. And then in 1998, I think the notion of multi-generation philanthropy changed in that Paul Shervish and John Havens from the Center for Wealth and Philanthropy in Boston College came out with this research about wealth transfer. And all of a sudden, we had this public conversation about wealth coming down the pike. And they said that $40 trillion would be transferred to baby boomers and their adult Gen X and Y children by the year 2052. And so we're already well underway in that transfer. And they believe at least half of that $20 trillion will go philanthropically through bequests and what they call inter vivos during lifetime giving. So that sort of opened up families having conversations during their lifetimes about preparing for these imminent responsibilities. We also know that average lifespans are increasing. In 1900 in America, the average American was living to age 47. I would be in retirement at the moment if that were the case. And then 2000, average lifespan has increased. I don't know what you would guess, but it's up to 79 for men and 82 for women. So a considerable evolution, and rather than having two generations with one passing the baton to someone in their 30s, we now have four generations of Americans over the age of 21 and around our philanthropic tables at the same time. So the slide in front of you, we call generational personalities. We try to understand and build empathy for the other generations who are around the table making philanthropic decisions together. And the quote reads, understanding the events and conditions each of us experiences during our formative years determines who we are and how we see the world. So to give you a little bit of a framing, we just went through some of these generational cohorts in when you selected which one you were from, right? But we know that traditionalists born between 1925 and 45 experienced events such as the invention of the airplane and movies, right, and automobiles, but really the lasting imprimatur of that generation is the Great Depression, segregation in the South, the onset of World War II and the Holocaust, right, and this cultivation of values of patriotism, loyalty, selflessness, waste not, want not, and philanthropically, the investment in local communities, in institutions, really, that 100 years later are seen as the pillars of our communities today. For boomers, and I know many of you on the phone are, so I'm sure you have your own events and conditions that inform you that are not on this list. It's obviously not comprehensive, but born between 1946 and 64, post-World War II economic boom, the invention of the television brought the world into the boomers' household, the civil rights movement, women's rights, Brown versus Board of Education, lots of social movement and change and the opportunity for people to feel like they could play a role in that change. So lots of optimism. And then, of course, realities of assassinations and onset of war and sort of this realism that came with optimism as well. And we know that boomers today are now on the board of, if not leading, the nonprofits, which they have probably served on for decades. And so we can imagine how it must feel for them to want to engage their kids in philanthropy and see their kids involved in the nonprofit life. And yet, what does it mean when an Xer is knocking at the door? What does it mean for that boomer, right? And so as an Xer myself, I like to build some empathy for those of us who often get a bad rap. But we live through Watergate and Iran-Contra and the downsizing of corporations our parents worked decades for. Our moms got to work, but then many of us became latchkey kids. The free love of Woodstock for the boomers looked like the AIDS epidemic for the Xers. The war on drugs added crack to the list, and by the way, the divorce rate tripled. So Xers really come by their cynicism and their skepticism naturally. So if you have dealt with Xers and you wonder why they're not feeling ready to jump in and roll up their sleeves, you know, they come automatically with questions, even about the very same institutions their grandparents may have initiated and their parents are leading. But they're incredibly independent and resourceful, and only 46 million of them. So they, compared to boomers, who are the largest cohort of the four with 80 million of them, so they've had a lot of room to move around and to find opportunities and to create new tables for philanthropy. And if you think of social entrepreneurial efforts well known in America today, Teach for America, Donors Choose, Do Something, Dress for Success, KIPP Schools, all founded by Xers. Right, and Yers, and you'll talk to a couple of them, hear from a couple of them in a few minutes. They lived through Oklahoma City, Columbine, Trade Towers coming down, right? We just had September 11th Memorial. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, lots of devastation on their own soil, and so we see this sort of uptick in civic participation and voting and volunteerism higher than Xers even. And so if you're trying to engage next geners, we often encourage people to think about, are you talking about a Gen Xer or a Gen Yer? Because there's lots of different opportunities with the different profiles. And of course, from the image on the screen, right, it sort of evokes what we know about Yers who grew up with the internet, cell phones essentially in the palm of their hand, texting and instant messaging, and now social networking. So they really have, of course, this access to information and expect it from the nonprofits with whom they're dealing. So as we move on to some of our next-gen research, I would just invite you to think about what's your events, what are the events and conditions you'd put on your list that you experienced growing up and that inform who you are and how you see the world, and how that informs who you align with and who you have dissimilarity with as you're trying to bridge the gap in working with donors. So you'll see, actually, Jamie's photo on this slide. She's going to speak with us in a minute. We felt like we needed to know more about the next generation of donors who are poised to inherit this $40 trillion transfer that we talked about. So we partnered with the Johnson Center for Philanthropy, and we did a fielded a study with the help of these organizations on the list and captured 310 qualified survey responses and 30 in-depth interviews, thanks to the funders who helped us to underwrite that. And I wanted to share with you quickly some of the key findings from that research to consider. So we know that Yers grew up with technology, and you might think that they're most influenced by Twitter, you know, on their giving. But really, we were surprised to find that 89% of them said that their parents and 63% of them their grandparents influenced next-gen donors' giving. And so how can you think about your institution having an opportunity to help families actually communicate about the importance of giving to their next generation of donors? And I included some quotes from our research. One of the fun things about this study was that we actually heard from the voices, not just inferred, but heard what they had to say. So one said, without question, my obligation and duty to this came from my parents and the childhood that I had. They were working on boards when we were young, giving money away before I could talk. That was the MO. That is what we do, right? A lot of people ask us, how are next-gen donors' priorities, their funding interests, aligning with those of previous generations? So we asked next-gen donors the causes they were most interested in supporting and what they perceived their parents were interested in supporting. And actually, the top two causes were the same for themselves and their parents. One would be education, and the second, basic needs. Those two are the top causes that they're most interested in and in alignment with their families. Down on the right, you'll see these emerging next-gen donor priorities, including animal welfare, environment, civil rights, and advocacy seem to be growing interests. And we also saw some divergent priorities, areas where they're prioritizing giving to these less than they believe their families are, healthcare, religion, arts and culture, youth and families. You know, some could hypothesize it may be the point of their lives that they fortunately haven't had a grave illness or something like that, so they're not yet prioritizing healthcare. I think some of these will change over time, but that's what the snapshot says at the moment. Second major finding is about impact, right? So while they perceive their parents to be motivated in their giving by relationship, by obligation, responsibility, they really focus on strategy and impact first. They want to see the impact they're having, and they want to know how they're playing a role in it, right? So I feel like generation-wise, we're really blazing a trail that's very different from the one that came before. It's okay to be passionate about giving, but it's important to do your due diligence on organizations and hold people accountable. So when we ask the top five most important components of philanthropic strategy, I want to just call out a couple, right, in particular. I conduct due diligence and do research before deciding whom to support. I first decide my philanthropic goals and solutions, and then I search for recipients. I fund efforts that address root causes, and I prefer to have information about organizations' proven effectiveness and measurable impact before deciding whether to support, right? So I'm sure that our colleagues on the phone will tell you in a minute, right, some organizations may approach NextGen donors and say, your parents supported this, I'm sure you want to too, and we know legacy, we heard legacy is important, but strategy and impact come first. So if you, the more you can sort of demonstrate that to your the people you're approaching for funding, the better. Okay, moving to the third finding, time, talent, treasure, and ties. I just want to focus on this element of ties that people in this generation are creating opportunities to work with their peers. And maybe, Amanda, you'll speak to this in a few minutes about really giving with their peers is causing them to be, hold each other more accountable and be more strategic in their focus, not only tell each other about their causes. And also this idea that time, talent, and treasure, while not unique to NextGen donors, looks different for this generation. They've been volunteering at quite a young age. So trying to pull up this data to show you. So by now, when you're engaging them, right, you can see here that over 90% in our study of NextGen donors said that they have been volunteering before the age of 20. So by the time they're ready to be engaged by a nonprofit as an adult, they don't just want to be on the social committee, right? They want to use their acumen to be making a critical difference in the life of an organization. And here are some of the ways that they imagine giving their time, talent, and treasure. Give online, they gave in-kind materials, volunteered their time, contributed to a charity, and so on. Hopefully that gives you some ideas. And lastly, I want to point out that they're crafting their philanthropic identities, right? So in a way, because we're talking about this age range and moving from adolescence to adulthood, next generation donors sometimes are simultaneously figuring out who they are in addition to what they want to fund, right? How do they align their values with their giving? So they're crafting their identities while we're working with them, and how to best help them do that. We asked them what most important influences on learning and developing personal philanthropy. And I would point out in particular this idea that they want personal experience as a donor or a volunteer to inform their giving, right? And they also want personal observation of an analysis of the significant need for philanthropy. So how do they not just hear about the importance of it, but how do they really see it come to life through site visits, through talking to people who are having, feeling the impact of the dollars they're contributing? So what does this mean? It means that they may not be planning to revolutionize with the manifesto in their drawer, but they're so interested in strategy and impact that they might just pull out different tools in the toolbox and take risks in a way that previous generations weren't. So they're holding honoring legacy at the same time as creating change. Crucial moment and opportunity for philanthropy now to engage the next generations. The question is how to do that. And hopefully we've given you some ideas today and so far in the research and in these slides. Excuse me. And I'm going to turn to our panelists to hear a little bit more from them as to what they think. So let me introduce you to Amanda Hirsch, who's the executive director of Books for Kids, which works to promote literacy among children with a special emphasis on low-income and at-risk preschool-age children. You can read more of her bio there. Amanda's been involved in a number of peer-based giving models as well as philanthropy with her family. So, Amanda, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And then second, we have on the phone Jamie Mayer Finney. Let me scroll back so I can show you her photo as well. And Jamie is a trustee of the Nathan Cummings Foundation. I don't know if the slide is pushing out. And fourth-generation member of that family who's been involved in the foundation for probably since you were 15, I think. So let's go to both of you. If you can just start by even saying a word about how you see this, some of these key findings. Jamie, maybe you can start sort of on the balance between legacy and strategy and impact.
Absolutely.
How do you hold both of those?
I think the
the tricky part of the legacy piece is finding your own place in the legacy and not legacy for legacy's sake. So many organizations come to me and say, similar to what Sharna was saying earlier, you know, your grandmother has always given to us, your father has always given to us. To me, that's the biggest turnoff in the world. I want organizations that I really care about that, you know, someday will go to my children and say, your mother always gave to us, and they'll say, great, we want to find our own organizations. So to go to the findings that Sharna was mentioning, legacy plays a huge piece, but it's finding your own place within that and trying to find a strategic hold in the work of an organization that may have meant a lot to your parents and grandparents and an in for you that's very different from the ownership that they had in the organization, if that makes sense.
Amanda, can you say a word about what's been the legacy for you, whether it's from your family or some of the events and conditions you experienced growing up that's informed your philanthropy?
Sure. I have a different sort of perspective than Jamie, just because the philanthropy in my family really only goes back one generation above me. So it's really not sort of about finding my legacy and more about just sort of my parents have just given me sort of the leisure of being able to choose what I want to give to. And something that resonated with me from Sharna's earlier slides is just the key factors when looking at who to support and what is the impact and are my dollars really making a difference and where are they going exactly and what are the measures of success. So that's what's where I sort of approach it from. And as somebody who is now, you know, running a nonprofit, that's also a lot of what I get from. We have a lot of younger donors, and we have a few active junior board members, and that's always sort of the same question that they approach me with is, okay, you guys build libraries, and then what happens? What is the measure of success? You know, what is the organization really doing to make a difference?
So talk a little bit about, as an independent adult, right, perhaps separate from your families and the influence or legacy they've had on you, you know, how do you approach your giving? Do these questions about strategy and impact resonate with you? How have you established yourselves as funders?
So those questions are very important to me, and because I sort of don't have the same giving structure as a formal foundation like Jamie's family, I've been able to kind of go off and do my own thing, and one of the things that I've done is get involved with a peer giving group. So actually came to it through Sharna and some other initiatives out of 2164, and it's a fund where we all give money and then are able to evaluate a number of organizations based on a number of different factors. We read applications from different organizations, then do site visits and evaluate as a group which organizations we think would be the most worthy of the money that we are giving together. So that's something that I've been able, you know, that I've done aside from my family.
And Jamie, will you say a word about how the fourth generation in your family has distinguished itself philanthropically?
Of course. I'll speak about the foundation piece and then also individually outside of the foundation if that works. So
yeah.
Within the foundation, my family's foundation was created posthumously, so after my great-grandfather had passed away. So my parents' generation really set up the foundation and the core program areas and what have you. And for my generation, there was a big fear, like Sharna mentioned, with her study and how the findings of the study for many people were very optimistic because legacy placed so high. There was a big fear that my generation would want to have an overhaul and, like Sharna said, have manifestos in our desk drawers. And so we were given as a generation just over $1 million in a donor advised fund to do whatever we wanted with. We could make one grant. We could create our own foundation, miniature fund. We could give to organizations that the foundation already gave to. We could really choose to do whatever we wanted with it. And we took it upon ourselves to really professionalize the fund, to create a mini foundation, create bylaws, interview every member of our generation so that we could prove to our parents' generation that we were really serious and that we had our own ideas. And we made sure that our mission and our goals and our program areas weren't anything that Nathan Cummings Foundation was funding currently, so that we weren't duplicating efforts. And we made sure that all of my generation had buy-in and we were all interested in the program areas. And we had a 3-year spend down and learned so much in differentiating ourselves as a generation and giving separately from the foundation that then when we were brought back into the foundation as trustees, we're able to come to the table with a much stronger personal viewpoint of philanthropy, the way that we choose to give, the interests that we have, and a way to really have a background and say, but we've done this before. Here's our track record. And individually, I would say I look at my philanthropy similar to Amanda. I also work in nonprofit. And it's a tricky line when you work in nonprofit and you're also a philanthropist in figuring out how you want to make your name for yourself as a funder. If you want to make a name for yourself, you might prefer to be anonymous. And for me, in finding my individuality in my philanthropy, I think of it the same way as I'm a theater producer by trade. And whenever I look at a piece of theater that I might want to produce, I always think of my artistic aesthetic. And if that piece, if it could do amazingly well on Broadway, make tons of money, tour, become a movie, so on and so forth, if it's not my artistic aesthetic, I don't want it to go out there because with my name on it, then that becomes a part of my artistic integrity. And I take that exact same viewpoint when it comes to my philanthropy.
So you're raising an interesting point in that young people, next generation donors, may want to be associated with their family's giving, may want to stand individually based on their own personal interests, passions, aesthetic. Amanda, will you say a word about how you would want a development officer or fundraiser to relate to you? Because I know your family foundation or family philanthropy, I should say, setup looks differently. Do you want people to approach you independently, assume you're with your family, et cetera?
I think I would like to be approached independently. An organization that I've been involved with for a long time actually approached me through my family, but it was more along the lines of, we saw you at this luncheon. We really could use a younger generation of leaders. Would you be interested in, partaking? So it was sort of a combination of both. It's like they understood that I was interested in the event, in the organization because I was at the event and enjoyed it. But it was also like, do you want to become a leader of a younger generation of givers for this organization and be a part of the structure and what that means, that means to be, a part of this and forge your own sort of path to being a leader for this organization at a younger generation. So I do appreciate being approached individually, but I think it's okay if it sort of comes out of, an introduction through a family.
Okay. And before we open the floor up, I want to make sure we shift to some really tangible examples of how organizations can engage next-gen donors, right, in a very meaningful, hands-on way. So in addition to, coming to galas, how would you How have you been involved in meaningful ways? How would you like to be? Give everyone some tangible examples.
I can say on my end, I hate the word junior. I hate the word young. I hate any word that makes it sound like whatever work I might be doing might be lesser than that of the board or any committee of an organization. So when someone asks me to join a junior board, I just kind of cringe at the thought of it. I look for places where I can be generative, similar to the example that Amanda just gave. I was at a gala that I'd gone to. It was a childhood friend's mother on the board of the organization, kind of typical story, and a sea of blue-haired people, no young people. I walked up to the director of development, and I said, you know, I'm going to bring you young people, and we're going to create a program, and we're going to figure out how to do this. And we created a professionals council that's now in its fourth year and going strong and have created an entire new audience and new branding for this organization that appeals to a much younger demographic. And any way to get your hands dirty that isn't just lip service, I would say. There's a lot of lip service out there to make us feel like we're being generative until you get the check. And then once an organization gets a check, you never hear from them again. We, as a generation, similar to all of the slides that that Sharna presented earlier, we all like to, even though at the end of the day we might know that organizations want our money, we like to be used for our brains. We like to be used for what we can bring to the table, and a check might come along with that. But any way that we can really be a part of creating something and have a stake in the organization is so much more appealing.
I agree with that, and I agree with sort of rolling up your sleeves and getting a little bit dirty and actually doing volunteer events and days, and that's what, you know, our, I know you don't like this word, Jamie, but what our junior board looks for at the organization where I work is always like, what can we actually do? We don't just want to give money. What could we actually do for you? And so I do think that's important to provide some kind of real hands-on opportunity, and to start something and to really kind of take ownership of some part of the organization.
So what's coming up for me as you both are describing these ideas is that not all nonprofit professional fundraisers, development officers might know this without asking, right? So if you're used to cultivating traditionalists and boomers, you might not know what's best for an X or an Y. So is it okay to ask you how you want to be involved, how you want to participate?
I think that's what I look for, and you know, a little bit of sort of freedom to decide what we think might work best, but also with support of, you know, of the office of, you know, the nonprofit. I mean, a good example is this organization which I spoke about before that I'm involved with. They've undergone a little bit of transition in the last year with a new president and downsizing and sort of changing a lot of internal structure. And, you know, unfortunately that it's trickled down to us in a way where we're not really getting the support we need from the organization, and we don't really have a contact person, and we have all these great ideas and all these things that we want to do this year, and we don't have any support. So, yes, we want to forge our own way, and we want to forge our own path as to what we think might work best with our generation, but we need support from the office, and we don't want to feel like the last priority. Like right now, our group is feeling like, well, okay, you guys have had a lot of internal structure issues, and we understand you're understaffed and things have changed, but you've got a group of young people here that are really have the potential to be very powerful leaders for this organization and for a new generation of people, and you guys are treating us like we're last priority. And it's a huge turnoff, and they're going to lose a number of good people.
If I can just add one thing, at Nathan Cummins, one thing that we do when we're looking at new strategies, we call our grantees grant partners. We bring our grant partners to the table and ask them in the field what they see the big problems to be, what they think some of the best solutions could be, what they think some of the cross sections might be between their field and another field to really solve the wicked problems in the world. And we make sure that they're side by side with us. So there isn't a power dynamic. There's always some kind of power dynamic when you're the person with a checkbook, whether you like it or not. And in terms of organizations being courted as a philanthropist, I would say it's the exact same as how we treat our grant partners. If an organization is trying to create a program for, as much as I hate the word, for young partners, junior associates, young professionals, counsel, whatever it might be, to create a program at someone instead of with them is such a big turnoff. And I would say similar to the way that we do our strategic planning at Nathan Cummings, have Gen Y, have Gen X, whoever you're creating the program for, even if it's a program for traditionalists, invite them to lunch, show that you care, have one-on-one conversations so they understand that they're actually worth something to the organization and they're a value add and not just a check, and make sure that their voice is heard and that they know that their voice is heard.
Thank you so much for your candor. I'm mindful of the time. I want to just note that I have up on the screen some of our tools, 2164 tools that we've found helpful in generating conversations with next-generation donors and with multi-generational families. If that's helpful to you, please feel free to check them out. And then, Margaret, let me turn it back over to you, because I know you want to field some questions that have come in from the audience, and we're all happy to answer them in our remaining 5 minutes together.
Great. One of the first questions that I'm looking at is from Christina, and I think that this is something that organizations deal with all the time, no matter what sort of initiative they're talking about. But she says, when boards just want to see immediate results, how do you convince them to start working on next generation of donors?
So I've felt this firsthand myself, and this is definitely a medium or long-term proposition, but it's not just that. We have been working with a national organization that has chapters in many cities around the country as one of our 2164's clients. And we invited them to actually hire a third-party evaluator to measure the impact we've been having on by working with next-generation donors and families who want to engage their children in this institution that they've been supporting for generations. And in 18 months, they already started to see quantitative, not just qualitative, returns, right? Frankly, millions of dollars come in because families who had wanted to see the institution as more than a deposit for their charity, but a place which is their community, which is helping them have conversations with their children about transmitting their values and this as part of their legacy, were able all of a sudden to do this at that organization, right? When we build trust with a donor over time, they want an opportunity to have these conversations with their children, which are sometimes hard to open up. And if you as a development officer have built that trust and are able to frame that conversation with them, what are you transmitting to your kids? What do you hope for them? How do you hope them grow into their own philanthropic identity? That's going to be very meaningful. So we've seen short-term returns, even though we see it as a medium and long-term strategic plan. Hope that's helpful, and I can talk more about it with you offline if you'd like.
Does anyone else would like to talk about that particular question?
It's the million-dollar question. I deal with that all the time as well. And for me, with any nonprofit that I am currently working with or have worked with in the past in trying to get a younger donor base, it's really getting the generation sitting around the board table to have a buy-in for some kind of succession planning for the organization. And for me, when you put it in succession planning terminology and you think about the legacy of the organization, you're going to think about the succession of the executive director or the CEO and the succession of the staff and the succession of the board whenever the president rotates off and so on and so forth. And when you put it in those terms, I've found that it becomes much more palatable that there isn't a return today and you're investing in the future. But it is. It's a huge, huge problem, and it's hard to get a board to sign off on it. So I feel for you.
The next question that we have, I don't think we really have time to answer it, but I think what we'll try to do is maybe make a short feature out of it or put it in our newsletter, and we'll be in touch with our speakers to have this question asked, because it's probably a very important question that is going to take more than 30 seconds to answer. But in the few seconds that we do have left, Sharna, do you want to wrap up really quickly and just let people know what they should be taking away from this session?
I just want to thank you all for dialing in for it, and thank Amanda and Jamie for sharing their personal stories and being so candid with us. I think there's an opportunity to engage not just one but two generations over the age of 21 in your organizations, and you can hear the eagerness, right, in the voices of next-gen donors to be meaningfully engaged. So I hope you'll ask them. I hope you'll think about creating new opportunities to bring them in and show them the work and let them roll up their sleeves and bring in their acumen as well as their usefulness to the organization. So thank you.
Great, thank you. And on behalf of Fundraising Success, I want to thank everyone for attending the session. I want to thank our speakers. It was really a wonderfully informative session. I was checking the networking lounge, and people were talking about it, so that's good. In order to download the tracking documentation that you need in order to claim the CFRE points, please click on the resource widget below. It's marked with a file folder. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, please visit the networking lounge. And also stick around for our closing session, which is taking place in just a few minutes. And remember, if you missed anything today, the entire show will be archived and will be available on demand for 3 months starting on Monday. Have a great day, everyone, and thank you for joining us.